Thank you very much indeed. We were, as John said, asked to look at the supply side, but of course it doesn't make much sense in looking at the supply side if one doesn't recognise that the demand side is quite important, and I'll come on to that in a moment or two. It has also to be said that this is the latest in a whole series of reviews that have looked at science and mathematics education. And in fact, it was Lisa Jardine who pointed out to me that these started probably in the 19th century and possibly before, and much of what Cavendish said then is relevant now. And indeed, one of the things that we did in the report was to actually reprint some of the recommendations that have been made over the past 130 or so years. And we did make the point that actually now is not the time for more reports. It is actually the time to act on consistent recommendations. The background, as you've heard, is that we were set up in April as one of five expert groups. The call for these originated in what was DEIS and rapidly became BIS, but it was clear that education is actually a DCSF responsibility in schools, and so it was agreed that we would do our work jointly. And we were asked to focus on the 14 to 19 age group, but it's clear, of course, that education doesn't start at 14, and there are some very important issues before that. And we were asked very much to look at the stretch end of education, if I can put it that way, to look at science education and mathematics education for those youngsters who have the potential aptitude to go to university to read one of the natural sciences, say, or mathematics or engineering. We consulted quite widely. We had a strong written response. We had about 30 one-to-one meetings. We had focus groups. We visited schools. And we then road tested our recommendations. So the first thing to say is that it isn't all terrible. And there has been a great deal of interest in science and mathematics education. One can debate how effective it's been, but I think that there is, in political circles generally, a recognition that this is an important topic for the UK. If you look at the numbers, you can, of course, argue about what the numbers mean, but there is rising participation and achievement as judged by grades. In most science and mathematics subjects at the different stages. And overall, the applications to study science and engineering are growing, but less so in some subjects than in others. And if you look at the indicators that compare us with other countries, we're broadly similar compared to the highly developed countries. But that is not good enough. And there was a very consistent series of responses to our consultation. I think, firstly, looking at the demand side, if you look at what the resources that the United Kingdom has, we're not rich in natural resources. What we're rich in is actually human resources. And the future for the UK has got to be that we've got to develop and use our brains to the best possible effect. And I think there's little argument about that. Secondly, there's absolutely consistent concerns that young people coming to university to read engineering, to read physics, to read chemistry, don't have the depth of knowledge that is expected for them, and a sense that that has changed over time, and in particular, not enough maths, skills, and knowledge in people coming to university to read subjects that demand a lot of maths. There's a shortage of specialist teachers. 25% of schools don't have a specialised physics teacher. And I think, again, agreement that the accountability systems in schools don't really incentivise them to focus on CPD, continuous professional development, for teaching staff. And I'll come back to governance and accountability later on. So the areas of our recommendations, in a sense, are fairly self-evident. There is a triangle of teaching, curriculum, and the assessment. And if you get any one of those three wrong, then it's likely that the educational experience for the youngster will not be the best. And I think, I'll come on to this, quite a strong sense that the driver in this triangle is the assessment, that actually it's examinations that become the tail that wags the dog, and children increasingly get taught to pass the test. And in fact, there are some websites which pretty much say, you know, if you read our book, you don't need to know anything else. Endorsed by a particular examination authority. So that's an issue. Within that triangle, there is, of course, the whole issue of the ethos of schools and higher education colleges. And as someone said to us in our consultation, you know an institution that has a good ethos when you see it. And then the fifth area is the whole question about market pull. Because if young people aren't persuaded that it's a good thing, and if they do science, mathematics, there will be something at the end of it, then there's no intrinsic reason that physics is superior to French or economics or anything else. The case has to be made, and youngsters have got to be drawn to the subject. And of course, that happens quite early in life. By the time you get to 14, it's probably getting a bit late. So we made recommendations in each of these areas. And I'll spend a few minutes now going through the areas of our recommendations, which pick up on each of these. So I think most people would accept that we need teachers who are qualified, who have background training in the subjects that they're teaching. And it was interesting talking to youngsters in a school in North Kensington, asking 15-year-olds if they knew whether a teacher in physics had a degree in physics or not. And they laughed at us and said, of course we know, because they can't answer our questions if they don't have a degree. So subject specialist training, there is an opportunity at the moment with the economic crisis when physics in the city is less attractive than it once was, for physicists to perhaps go into education. Secondly, it's easy to talk about recruitment, but retention is equally important. And there's data from DCSF that suggests that up to 40% of science and math teachers who qualified in 1999 weren't in the profession 5 years later. And so you've only got to change the retention figures by quite a small amount, and that actually will make a big difference. And then that comes down to looking after teachers in terms of career development, continuous professional development, and making it attractive for teachers to stay in education. And it is absolutely clear that continuous professional development, and particularly specialist CPD, is something that is undervalued and unrewarded. And if I take medicine, which was my profession, it was a big cultural change to get CPD into medicine. It would seem self-evident that doctors ought to keep up to date, but actually that was quite a big cultural change when it happened. And a similar cultural change is needed in CPD. And there need to be levers. And two possible levers are around career progression and indeed retention. And secondly, there needs to be accountability mechanisms that says that in the school governance framework, the executive needs to be held to account as to whether they've provided CPD for their staff. When we come to curriculum, there's quite a strong sense, and this applies to assessment as well, that the gearbox has become disengaged from the engine. And the people who need to be involved in both curriculum and assessment, who are the professionals in the field, HEIs, professional bodies, the teachers themselves, have become somewhat disengaged from the process of devising the curriculum and assessing it. And so it's extremely important that these communities become re-engaged and are made accountable collectively for making sure that curriculum and examination works well. And so we recommended that standing STEM expert groups should be established in each subject area to advise on the development of curricula and on the criteria for the examination. And I have to say, there's a wonderful jargon in all of this, and we actually put a glossary in our report because I kept having to learn the meaning of new words, as it were. There was general agreement that mathematics content is insufficient in the science curriculum, and it's an integral part of it, and the mathematics content does need to be boosted substantially within 14 to 19 science education. And actually that applies in physics, it applies in chemistry, but it applies in biology as well. A strong sense that in-depth learning needs to be increased. The opportunities for someone to pursue a subject in depth, the opportunity that actually exists to undertake an extended project, which will teach people about hypothesis generation, about experimental science, learn about something in some depth, and the possibility, indeed, that an extended project might form part of a portfolio that a young person would use as part of their HEI submission, in much the same way as you don't get into art school on the basis of your art theoretical knowledge. You actually have a portfolio. No reason in a sense why an extended project couldn't be used in that way. On assessment, there are two issues. There's the overall burden of exams, which has gone up. As exams have become modular, there's become the opportunity to take them earlier, repeat them, and we argued that they recommended that the module examination should be restricted to a single period in the summer term. The exams themselves need to become better constructed, and obviously it's easy to make these as generic criticisms. It's not that every exam question isn't good, but more work needs to be done to strengthen the quality of the examination questions and making sure that these test in-depth problem solving and deeper understanding of the subject. This was a recommendation that was actually on accuracy. It was actually made by J.J. Thompson in 1918, when he made the point that actually it wouldn't be a bad thing for scientists to be able to communicate clearly in English, and actually the grammar of an answer is important. And I think, again, communication is extremely important. In England, we have three examination bodies, and there's a sense that the competition between them is a competition that has the dangers of lowering standards, because in a way they're competing on whether students can potentially get the best results. And so there are two potential solutions to that. One is to reduce the number of examination bodies. The other is to have regulation that ensures that the examination bodies don't compete with each other to reduce the standards rather than to raise them. And as I've already implied, the practice of awarding bodies actually endorsing textbooks for their own examinations did not seem to be a good thing, and we had quite a lot of feedback on that subject, and we recommended that it should be stopped. I've already really prefaced my remarks on market pull. Youngsters need high-quality, consistent information about STEM subjects. This is something that ideally should be delivered in the classroom by their science teacher, so that in the classes it becomes clear what the relevance of the subject is to what the opportunities are in the outside world. And there are tremendous opportunities for links with HEIs and employers. And one of the things we made clear is there needs to be greater collaboration in science education. It will be a long while before there's a physics qualified teacher in every school. Schools need to collaborate until that happens. And that already happens successfully in mathematics. So there are opportunities and examples of how this can work. On school and college ethos, which seemed a somewhat soft area, it became, I think, an area for one of our most important recommendations, which is that the challenge for a school is that it has so many things that it needs to provide. And what schools, in a way, need is the equivalent of the corporate combined code or the charity SORP, which sets out a whole series of criteria which will aid the governing body to provide both support and challenge. And areas that would be covered by this would include career development for teachers, retention, promotion, continuous professional development, has it been done, are you collaborating, the availability of guidance and enrichment. And if there was a clear statement of recommended practice within which schools could be governed and challenged, that might be much more effective than a blanket how many A's to C's do you get in GCSEs or whatever. And clearly there needs to be strong subject leadership. So to wind up, the overarching themes were really that the way forward is actually about empowering teachers. It's actually about making sure that there are well-qualified teachers who are empowered to teach the subject in ways that are interesting, to approach the subject in depth, and join them up with the wider science and mathematics community and enable them to use their professional judgment. That needs to be done in the context of secure subject content and standards, which is why there needs to be good governance at the level of the examining bodies and QCDA, QCA, etc. And governance and accountability needs to be embedded throughout the system. And recognizing the topic of this meeting, there do need to be better pull mechanisms, because it is all very well pushing, but unless there's actually something at the end of it transparently for the youngsters, then why on earth should they do it? Thank you very much for your attention.